All right, good evening everyone, and thank you so much for coming out tonight. And I was driving here, it was pouring rain, I thought, oh, there'll be no one there, it'll be a great night. But it's so good to see you all here. I used to think I was young, and it wasn't that long ago I was sitting up there in the back row, thought I was a great guy, and now I'm just old and got kids. And so, but it's great to see this is still going, and it's really exciting for me to see that. It's good to see the technology is still the same as well with all the mistakes. But tonight there's no reading because we need to, they've asked me to summarise the life of King David in 45 minutes or so. So we're going to fly through tonight, hopefully. Now, I hope in Daniel last time he talked about some of the challenges that David went through when he was pre-king. And he was only a young boy, and there was challenges like Goliath. You know, when he was took that on in his life at such a young age, he had courage, he had faith, didn't he? And he also had incredible restraint, because remember, before he became king, he was running around hiding in caves with a bunch of crazy guys who would kill anyone and anything that he told them to. So imagine when Saul came in, he had that opportunity as well, where he had to hold them all back, these battle-hardened men. And he was also patient and he was passionate. But most of all, he loved his God, and that's the most important thing. And these qualities built him up as a young man to become the next king of Israel, and that's what we're going to look at tonight. Now, does anyone know any significant events that happened to King David in his period of reign? Right, there's Bathsheba. Anything else?
Absalom.
Absalom, yes.
Taking Jerusalem,
yes. Anything else? That's great. It's good. Because I picked three tonight because we don't have enough time. But yes, there is all these different things. So first of all, he takes over and he has to unite Israel. It's a divided nation. And then there's a promise to David. Remember, it was made, and it's talking about Solomon that was going to come and build the temple. Now, I'm not looking at that. Dion is looking at that in the next class. We're going to look at then Uzzah. Remember Uzzah, he touched the ark and was killed for that. And then last we'll look at David and Bathsheba. So the incredible thing I find about David is he can be so relatable in his life. And it's the point of these classes. You come out here because you want to learn something from tonight, hopefully. You want to see, well, they made mistakes in their life. Well, how did they change their ways? What was their faith in their God like? And so we're looking at King David tonight. We know that David wore his heart on his sleeve, and we're going to follow that in his journey tonight. So these key events and the decisions that David makes tonight that has massive ramifications on not only the kingdom but on his family, and the decisions he makes, as we'll see and as you probably know, aren't the wisest thing. Now, it starts off in 2 Samuel chapter 1. We see this very sad moment, isn't it? You might have ended this last time, when David learns of the death of Saul and his best friend, or one of his closest friends, Jonathan. And he's particularly sad. He's killed in battle. And that's the context of where we start tonight in 2 Samuel chapter 2. We go over there. We'll start here and we'll go through that. 2 Samuel chapter 2. And in verse 1 and 2, and after David inquired of Yahweh, should I go up to one of the cities of Judah? And Yahweh said, go up. And David asked, where should I go? And Yahweh replied, to Hebron. So David went up along with his family, and he comes here, and he inquires of God, doesn't he? And he goes up, and at this point, he takes over, and he's ruling half of the kingdom. Because the other, he rules Judah for about 7 years. And the other half is ruled by the guy who ran the army under King Saul. Now, it's important to note that all through David's kingship, there's killing, murder, death, bloodshed, everywhere, all of the time. And ultimately, that was the reason that God said, wasn't it, well, you're not going to build the temple for me, that's going to be for your son Solomon. So Israel's this divided kingdom. And Abner, in 2 Samuel chapter 2 and verse 8, he oversaw Saul's army. And he appoints Ish-bosheth king of Israel. So you've got Judah and Israel. And Abner just basically scared Ish-bosheth to do what he wanted anyway. So basically Abner was running the place. And so these wars and these battles, they escalate between the two parties, and especially at the hands of a man called Joab, who's this ruthless soldier of David. And then basically what happens is Abner, remember he's running the other side, Joab ends up killing Abner in chapter 3 in verse 27. And Joab had waited a long time for this, and he tricks him in verse 27. When Abner returned to Hebron, Joab takes him aside at the gate as if to talk to him privately. So he goes, come here, come over here. And he goes up and he puts his arm around him, doesn't he, in verse 27, and he stabs him in the stomach and kills him. And so that leader, that leaves Ish-bosheth, the son, in place. Abner's now dead. And David, when he finds out about this, is not happy about this. But because what happens then is Ish-bosheth gets then, he's sleeping. This is all background to the story. And these men go in and they kill Ish-bosheth while he's asleep on his bed. And in 2 Samuel 4 and verse 11, David calls these men wicked. They're wicked men. And David did what he did in the past. Remember when he heard about Jonathan and Saul, the guy thought he was going to be, you know, promoted through the ranks and just killed him. So in 2 Samuel chapter 4 and verse 11 and 12, David issues orders to the soldiers and he puts them to death and they cut off their hands and so on. You can read that for yourself. So you see here, it's not a united Israel, is it? There's bloodshed, there's chaos, and David really needs to bring the nation together if there are any chance of defeating the enemies that surrounded them. So in chapter 5 and verse 3, we see this commencing in the story. It says there, you will shepherd my people, and then in verse 3, we, all the leaders of Israel, came to the king at Hebron. King David made an agreement with them in Hebron before Yahweh, and they designated David as king over Israel. And that also in verse 4, it confirms that. So he was about 30 years old when he began his reign over the whole nation. So I don't know if there's anyone who's 30 here, but you're probably on the other end of the scale. I'm past 30, but so he's 30, it's not that old. And when you get to 30, you think it's not that old, okay? So he's gone on this exhausting journey we saw with the pre-king. We get to this king, there's chaos everywhere, people getting killed, and he takes over as king. And David says in 2 Samuel 4, verse 9, as surely as the Lord lives, he has delivered my life from all adversity. So even though he's young, he's been through a lot, he gives praise to God for being with him in his life so far. And it's a lesson for us in life. When life is tough, and there may be things in your life which are like what David went through, maybe not to the same extent, but, you know, betrayal, death of close friends or family, fighting, infighting in families, deceit. I don't know what you've gone through in your life. But like, if we're going to learn lessons from tonight, it's David, isn't it? He turns to God in prayer and comfort, and he says there, he delivered my life out of these troubles. David writes a psalm. It's one of my favourite psalms, and I probably quote it too much in the Bible because I think it's something we can remember as well. It's one of my favourite things. Psalm 34 and verse 15, if we ever feel like this, like David did all the time, or a lot in his life, not all the time, a lot in his life, Psalm 34 and verse 15 says, the Lord pays attention to the godly and he hears their cry for help. And verse 17, the godly cry out and the Lord hears. He saves them from all their troubles. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted. He delivers those who are discouraged. And David wrote those words. So if you ever feel that, read those words again. When life seems too much and it's overwhelming, know that King David, a man after God's own heart, could be in the same situation as you. And he turned to his God for help all the time. So it's a lesson for us. So we now move on. He's united Israel. He's the king now. And so with all that, he started to unite. Everyone's behind him. And then we hear about the story of Uzzah. And it's a Sunday. It is a Sunday school story. And what do we know about the ark? Well, the ark was where God dwelt on earth, wasn't it? And it was in the tabernacle. And it was in the most holy place. So it was special. And there was nothing more sacred at those times than the ark, was there? It was holy, it was special. And yet when we read this story of Uzzah, we're at right at the end of the story and we're like, well, he was just trying to stop it falling off a cart. He was well-intentioned. Why did he have to die? Because he touched the ark. Because remember when this story started? The story started in 1 Samuel, way back in 1 Samuel chapter 4. Does anyone know what happened while the ark wasn't in Israel? Yeah, so what happened before that, though? Yeah, they thought, we're going to grab this piece of furniture, which is what they treated it like, and they thought, we're losing a battle, we'll take it out in the field and we'll start winning. And they didn't win, and like you said, the Philistines capture the ark, and they take it away, don't they? And then the Philistines discover, well, this ark that we've captured, yeah, we think it was great, and then all these people started dying around them, didn't they? And sores and things went through them. And so the ark's up, you know, when they were at Aphek. And there's a heavy loss of Israeli life. And so it didn't work out for them. And we need to bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord from Shiloh that it may come among us and save us from our enemies. And this is what they did. And it didn't work. And it sets off the chain of events way back then that ultimately results in the death of Uzzah tonight. So they capture the Ark. They knew that it had to be returned. We need to get rid of this thing. And they outline a plan, don't they, in 1 Samuel 6, of how to get the ark back. Now, they were Philistines. They didn't know. They weren't allowed to touch it or certain people were only allowed to touch it. So they said, we'll do this test with some cows. If they head off in a certain direction with the new calves, and they did a little test. And they decided with the cow experiment that the ark is going to go home. And they were very thankful for that. So that with respect... And the Philistines didn't have a guidebook on how to return arks to Israel, did they? They didn't, you know, there wasn't, you know, looking through like that. So they decide to return the ark, and you can see how much detail had been given to the capture and the return of the ark. See how much trouble they took to anyone who dared to profane the holiness of God. This is holy, it represented God. There were so many people that died and were afflicted by it. David knew the history of this. He knew where the ark was. Uzzah knew the history of it. All Israel that were there together, they knew the history of the ark. And everyone knew why the ark of God happened to be where it was. And 20 years go by, and David is now king. The nation's claimed, and David says, you know what we need to do? It's time to bring the ark of God back to the tabernacle in God's city. And that's what we're reading about here in chapter 6, verse 1 of 2 Samuel. This is a significant event. He assembled all the best men in Israel, 30,000 in number. It's this momentous event and ceremony. It was one of the first things he does as he brings this nation together. A new chapter in their life, in their history. And then he says, and David and all the men who were with him traveled to Baalah in Judah to bring from the ark, which is called by the name of Yahweh of hosts, who sits enthroned between the cherubim that are enthroned on. So this long name. So it's not just the ark. It describes what the ark represented. It's holy. It's not just a piece of furniture. And it represented at that time God in the world, in this world, and is symbol of him here. So everything that you would, if you were to approach God, had to be done with in accordance to how God wanted it. But then we read, well, what David does in verse 3, he loads the ark of God onto a new cart. So they arrange a new cart. Well, I guess that's not the same cart as the Philistines had, so that's good enough. They get this new cart, and they come up with this protocol of returning the ark. The ark was to be transported according to some sort of plan that even the Philistines came up with. It wasn't being transported how God had told them it was being transported. And so we see, unfortunately, there Uzzah, who was the son of Abinadab. Now, that's important because the house of Abinadab was where the ark was stored for 20 years. So Uzzah had grown up with this piece of furniture for what, when he was a kid, that's all he would know about. But then as he would learn about what this represented, he'd grown up around this for 20 years or so. So he would have heard about the stories that this ark had been through, wilderness wanderings, crossing the Jordan, the promised land. And right up to that fateful day when it arrives at his father's house. And in verse 5-7, when David and all Israel energetically celebrating before Yahweh, they were singing and they were so happy the ark had finally returned, they arrive at the threshing floor of Nacon. Uzzah, well, the ark, it shakes on the cart, it hits a pothole in the road, and it's going to fall, and Uzzah puts his hand down and he stops it. Yahweh was so furious with Uzzah, he killed him on the spot for his negligence. And he died right there beside the Ark of God. So tragedy strikes the ceremony, doesn't it? And you can imagine everyone's watching, at least 30,000 or more. Uzzah reaches out with all these good intentions. But it reminds you of those stories, doesn't it? Nadab and Abihu, Achan, Ananias and Sapphira. They all failed to take what God said seriously. This is how I want to do things. And here, they also didn't do it how God wanted it. And David was angry, wasn't it? Different commentators, they discuss whether David was angry at the situation or the carelessness leading up to it, particularly at Uzzah for breaching the protocols of God. Because in verse 9, it states there that David was afraid of God. So it seems that David's initial anger wasn't with God, but with himself or others in derailing. Well, it should have been an amazing day, shouldn't it? A triumphant day to bring this ark down back home to Israel. And so now he's too scared to do anything about it. And they park the ark back in storage in Obed-Edom. And it's there for 3 months, this ark. It sits there. And the house that it was stored in was blessed. And then David is encouraged again to try. Let's try again. Let's try and bring this ark back to its rightful home. And so the ark, the second time around, it's brought with rejoicing. There wasn't any bitterness recorded from David of what happened, but there was a renewed excitement. Okay, we're going to try again. And everyone would have been crystal clear of what God. They would have looked up, what do we have to do? And the celebrations commence again. And so we're told in verse 13, the Kohathites bore the ark. The cart's gone, isn't it? It no longer features at all. And it was calm and it was measured and they did the steps properly. And it was about 15 kilometres and they walked with this ark. So imagine walking with an ark, a box, a big ark for the 15 kilometres. So it would have taken a very slow, measured walk, the best part of a day. And then awaiting the ark was a very special tent. And remember this tent, because it's going to come up a little bit later. This tent was prepared by David. And we know because the temple, because he says, I want to build a temple. And God says, no, Solomon's going to do that. And he comes up this tent and he puts the ark in it. And David was clothed in chapter 15, verse in Chronicles 15, verse 27, David was clothed the robe of fine linen, as also were all the Levites, so everything was done properly. David would have been on high alert, wouldn't he, watching, making sure there was no disrespect for God's view of holiness. And so everyone returns home satisfied. Not only is Jerusalem theirs, but now the Ark of the Covenant is safely within the walls, or within the tent it was designated to be in. You got the king of Israel, David, mortal, and the immortal, the ark, the symbol of God, both together in a city of peace. And this is also bringing together God and the people, and all the people as a united spirit, wasn't it? Enthusiasm, a new spirit, generosity of the king, and it was a day to remember for everyone. So what's the lesson from Uzzah then? We want to see the lesson from Uzzah in the context that it was told in. It's not the case that unexpectedly the long-lost ark turned up. There was no history, there was no reference to go by, and they had to quickly come up with a plan and grab it. They knew what happened to Hophni and Phinehas way back in 1 Samuel. They knew that Eli, the priest, died because of what he heard happened to the ark. They knew the chaos that happened with the Philistines. And yet despite this, they find themselves in a situation where the ark's been trundled along on a cart behind some cows and on a path that's lumpy and bumpy and potholes and impediments. So the lesson is not that sometimes while having good intentions we make mistakes and that can hurt you. I don't think that's the lesson. We are imperfect and we need to attempt to keep speaking good words, do good actions, know that sometimes we're going to get it wrong. So we should keep having those good intentions. Learn from your mistakes, and that's how you grow in godliness. But that isn't the subject, I don't think, of this 2 Samuel 6. I think the lesson is the failure on all of their part to appreciate the holiness. We know that holiness means special, the holiness of God. And Uzzah just happened to be the poor guy at the end of the story who touched the ark. It wasn't just about Uzzah, was it? It was about the whole community, a failure in the community with devastating consequences. So it brings us to attention that while there is an allowance for human faults and blunders and mistakes in God, in the plan of God, which doesn't receive like instant judgment like Uzzah, we need to learn from that and we grow, and when we develop, you know, or when we make mistakes, we grow and we develop from that. But this is pointing out that there needs to be something in our heart. There needs to be a part of us that is sacred and consecrated, that we think about our God and how special he is for us. For Israel, it would have been the tabernacle, the offerings, the rituals, everything they did. For us, it should be about the memory of the Lord Jesus Christ. We sit every Sunday. It should be about that. It should be about the meeting you go to, the community. And that needs to be in your heart exclusively, without compromise and reserved to God, treated especially like they did the second time around, with care. And this protective armor that we have inside of us, that we appreciate the holiness of God. And that's a line that we draw in the sand, that we can never cross that line in our heart, in our walk towards the kingdom. And so with that misstep that happens, David is determined from that point on to do the right thing, isn't he? He conquers surrounding nations. He brings people with him in great victory. The NET Bible says in 2 Samuel 8 and verse 13 that he became famous. Verse 14, David was protected by God wherever he went for battle, wherever he campaigned. And the people loved it, because in verse 15 of chapter 8, it says there he delivered justice and fairness to his people. David reigned over all Israel. He guaranteed justice for all his people. And so that's why when we get to 2 Samuel chapter 11 and part of chapter 12, it's a turning point in the life of David. And to be really honest with you all, I've read this story over and over and over again. And I really struggled to not be disappointed with David and the decisions that he takes, and not to look down on him for the decisions he takes and the actions that occur. And yet when I reflect in my own life and lives with people in our community, we're often shocked, aren't we, that, you know, or even outraged, or we're surprised that this person that we held in such high regard could even sin at all. And yet people do. And we crush them into the ground, don't we? And so tonight we learn from David, this great fall of David that we're going to look at. It should give us a great lesson in our own lives, not only to stop and think, but to understand the consequences that can happen with our actions. So think about the choices you make in your life. The amazing thing is at the end of this whole thing, we really should feel we're so glad and we're so blessed, because our wonderful God says in 2 Samuel 12 and verse 13, Nathan says, "Yes, and Yahweh has forgiven your sin." How good is that to hang on to? Doesn't mean there's no consequences to life, but that's our amazing God. He says, "Yes, I've forgiven your sin." So I'm aware of the very sensitive nature of David's actions. And whilst many or no one I know has murdered anyone, the initial sin of David is one that many struggle with. Maybe not to the same extent or form, but in some form, especially in this day and age. So it's important to say, well, what is God? What is God's expectation? It's not from me. I can't say that. What's God's expectation? God, through our Lord Jesus Christ, he sets a standard for us all, particularly for us men, young men, older men, but although it's applicable to everyone. And he says, and he gives us two ideals, two expectations, and he says that in Matthew chapter 5, and verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said, 'Do not commit adultery.'" But secondly, he goes even further than that, and he says in verse 28, "But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to desire her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Our Lord was very aware of the struggles of sin that we all face. And he goes on and gives the extreme lessons in Matthew that, well, if it's that bad, if it's that much of a distraction, cut it off. It's better to cut it off and get it out of your life. And so before we scoff at David, David was and he isn't alone in the sin he committed. And on the other hand, it doesn't condone any of this very poor and outrageous behaviour of King David. In 2 Samuel 12, particularly the story that Nathan confronts David with, you imagine the devastation in his heart and the crushing reality as he, in pre-king years, he'd fought Goliath, and now he'd let Goliath into his mind. He'd let it run wild with lust. A quiet, caring, pre-king shepherd boy had grown into a man who at this moment had not looked after his flock like he was supposed to do. In fact, he wasn't just not looking after people. He manipulated a situation to suit himself. And in the process of that, he wreaked havoc on the lives of many families, and particularly God's family, the nation of Israel. And so we read the story in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and verse 1. In the spring of the year, at the time when kings normally conduct wars, David sent out Joab with his officers and the entire Israelite army. They defeated the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David stayed behind in Jerusalem. The entire Israelite army was sent out. Well, that's not actually true, is it? Because who was part of the Israelite army? It was King David. The king, their leader, who should have been there, was summed up in a simple sentence there: David stays behind in Jerusalem. And we can see in this chapter a change in the character of David. There's a little bit of arrogance setting in. Remember, he was famous. He was protected. He'd won a lot of battles around. Maybe the siege was too much. I can't be bothered. I'd rather have my own bed than being stuck out in a field with my men. And so David gives himself, in verse 1, gives himself some time off. But he's not busy in the service of the Lord. He was there in verse 2, lazing around in bed before he eventually decides to get up and he goes for a wander around the palace. A little lesson for us is to keep occupied. particularly with godly things, as much as we can, because without this in your mind, or your mind being occupied by godly things, your mind reverts back to a default position of our nature, doesn't it? Serving ourselves. And so with David, seemingly nothing to do, he wanders around, he grows restless in bed, he's bored, he wanders out to the balcony. And the other thing is, there was a lack at this time of people around him, friends, wasn't there? Real friends that he'd previously had in his life. There was no Jonathan, there was no Samuel, not even Abigail was there to stand up to him. Good looks, unchecked power, boredom, and the eyes. All a recipe for disaster. His eyes fix on something that rivets his attention on a woman, bathing herself, and David notes her beauty in verse 2. From the roof he saw a woman bathing. Now this woman was very attractive. He doesn't know who she is or whether she's married. We don't know how much David saw. We can all make assumptions on that, but we don't know for certain yet whether he sinned, do we? It wasn't necessarily evil either for him to discreetly inquire about her. If she was unmarried, she was eligible, he could have taken her for a wife, but the inquiry came back and made it quite clear in verse 3. Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite? And that's where the story should have ended. Like many who had gone before him and to this day. It's where the story should have ended. We take, what did Joseph do? He was presented with the same, it was a similar situation, a little bit in reverse. But the story there, he said, how can I do this and sin against my God? And he runs out. And so this report comes back telling him about Bathsheba. She's married. It's totally out of the question. He has no right, no matter his position or his power, to take another man's wife. And he also knows that Bathsheba's married to Uriah the Hittite. This isn't just some cadet, you know, John Smith soldier. Not that that would make it any better. But it isn't some nameless guy, some soldier David had never heard of. David has to know Uriah, even if he doesn't know who Bathsheba is. In 2 Samuel 23, verse 39, it talks about Uriah the Hittite, and he's named as one of David's mighty men. And he was known for his bravery and his courage as a soldier. But other than that, he was a proselyte. Does he know what a proselyte is? That's someone who's come into the truth. So he comes into the truth, and he's going to be treated like this. David, you know, he was used to having the best of everything, wasn't he? And he looks down from his penthouse suite, doesn't he? He looks down at this woman. He regards this woman as fine. How can this fine woman belong to a Hittite? She's fit for a king. Brother Harry Tennant says in his book, The Man Dave, and I think it sums up the whole event that was about to happen, in page 132, Bathsheba was beautiful, David was human, and his defences were down. And so a disaster unfolds. In verse 4, David sends messengers to her, and she came and she slept with him, and then it goes on, it was the end of the process of purifying herself, and she returns home. We aren't sure of a time period that passed, are we? But it seems that it never enters David's mind again after that encounter. There is no indication he wanted to continue the relationship with her or even marry her. He tries to put this sin out of his mind as though it was nothing. And then the message comes back, doesn't it, in verse 5, and it would have panicked him. It says, I'm pregnant. Time was now critical, wasn't it? People were going to start noticing. This was David's sin and his responsibility, and she tells him it's your responsibility as well, David. And so this is the time when he starts to stack one sin upon another, doesn't it? He's certain that each one that he does is going to wipe out the previous sin. Instead, it only gets worse and worse for David. More and more people become into this web that is weaving and cover-up is becoming impossible. Chapter 11, verse 6 to 9, it tells us, well, here's the plan. Send me Uriah the Hittite. It was going to be a simple idea. David will give Uriah the same opportunity, except that he'll be his own wife at his own home. And so after Uriah obviously has relations with Bathsheba, all will conclude that he was the father of the child and it wasn't David. There's a few things wrong, but one of the things wrong with David's plan, he assumes that Uriah is as spiritually indifferent as he is, and that he will actually act to indulge himself rather than act like a soldier of war. And that's where David was so wrong. This man, Uriah, was a faithful man, and the plan unraveled. Joab is now involved as well. There's favours going to be owed. People are being drawn in. Uriah's summoned back. Go straight to David. This mighty warrior, was to report about the battle directly to David. Uriah arrives back in Jerusalem. He reports to David. And there's this whole act, isn't there, and charade that he's put on as plan. Verse 7, he says, tell me about the welfare of the people. How's Joab going? How's the campaign going? What's the state of the war? David doesn't care about the war. All he can think about is covering up about his sin, and he needs to get Uriah home with his wife. David's changed, hasn't he, from a caring shepherd, the defender of his people, standing up to Goliath, and now he lacks compassion for the entire army, and specifically at this time for Uriah and Bathsheba. So David gives him the night off. He says, go and wash your feet. I'll see you in the morning. David is not worried about personal hygiene. David is like, read between the lines, Uriah, go home. Uriah knows it. The writer who writes this knows it, and we all know it. He sends this gift off. But faithful Uriah, at the end of verse 9, he never goes home, does he? He's an amazing man. But Uriah stayed at the door of the palace with all the servants of his lord. He did not go down to his house. He never leaves the king's house. He sleeps in the doorway with the king's servants. He was a faithful servant. He was faithful to David, his king. There is no way he was going home to enjoy a night with his wife. Instead, he turns around. What does he do? He guards. He stays with the soldiers who guard the life of the king. So this amazing person who was converted to the truth, it's just so, the irony of it is so overwhelming, isn't it? And this faithful soldier, he spends the night guarding the life of the king. The king who had taken his wife and will soon take his life. And so plan A doesn't work and plan B is implemented in verse 10 and 11. David is trying to make it clearer and more obvious after he receives reports that he didn't go home. He says there in verse 10, verse 10. So David, haven't you just arrived? Uriah replied to David, the ark and Israel and Judah reside in temporary shelters. Where was the ark put? It was put in a tent. He didn't want to live in luxuries while his soldiers and the ark of God was in a tent in the field, and none of them could be with their families. The ark, the dwelling place of God, is in the field. Your men are fighting in a battle. You're not out there with your God. And Uriah is now starting to act like David, like in his earlier days, isn't he? The David he should be. And he swears an oath in verse 11. He says, by your life, I will not do this thing. And so this plan B unravels again. And there's sin and complication. And then he goes to plan C in verse 12 and 13. David begins to eat and drink. He won't take no for an answer. And he offers food and drink to Uriah. He gets him so drunk. And in this condition, David sends Uriah home. Just go home and sleep it off. even drunk, Uriah would not violate his conscience. And at the end of verse 12, he tells us there, Uriah stayed in Jerusalem both that day and the following one. He did not go to his own house. So David is now desperate and he comes to plan D, doesn't he? Faithful Uriah must be put to death. The lesson for us, just for a pause for the moment, is that when things are going wrong for us in our life, we tend to try and sort it out ourselves, don't we? We never reach out to God in prayer. Don't stop talking to your God like David did at this moment. So plan D, Uriah needs to be killed off. And David would have been pacing all night, I imagine that, and he said, well, he hasn't gone home again. And so the last straw, David writes this letter, a death warrant, in verses 14 to 17. And in this letter, which Uriah holds and takes to Joab, it clearly outlines what Joab is to do and how he's to murder Uriah. In his eyes, it was foolproof. David was going to honour Uriah as a war hero, selflessly take on the duty of being a husband to Uriah's wife, taking care of the child, and of course, you're handing it to Joab, one of the most brutal men ever, and he complies completely with David's orders, and Uriah is eliminated, no longer an obstacle in David's plans. And so David's sin captures more and more people, doesn't it, leading to greater and greater sin. There needed to be an explanation about what had happened. Why so many? It wasn't just Uriah that was killed. There was a few people killed, wasn't there? Murdered. There needed to be an explanation in verse 18 to 25, sent to the king, of why these soldiers were killed in the battle. And Joab gives very specific instructions to be taken to the king, because Joab doesn't want to look like an idiot for what had happened. So he needs to get a bit of PR, spin on the situation. The entire mission was a fiasco. And Joab didn't want to see that. So Joab knows that David's going to react, doesn't he? He's going to hear this report back. And he's going to hypocritically react to this story. There's an attack. There's a result in these people were killed. And then at this point, the messenger was to say, just to drop into the conversation, oh, Uriah is also dead. And that would certainly end any protest or criticism on David's part. And so the report is brought back to King David by a messenger. And we see that in verse 22 to 24. The messenger departs and he arrives and he informs David all the news that Joab had sent him. The messenger said to David, the men overpowered us, attacked us in the field, but we forced them to retreat all the way to the door of the city gate. Then the archers shot at your servants from the wall, and some of the king's soldiers died. Your servant Uriah the Hittite is also dead. Imagine that's how he said it. He quickly adds that on the end, doesn't he? This is a devastating story, especially in the time that it was written. And if David was to be like he was supposed to be, then his reaction would have been, well, what happened when Jonathan and Saul were killed? Or Abner? But in this moment, he was callous. He was indifferent about the loss of one of his most loyal soldiers who was prepared to die for him. And in verse 25, he says, oh, tell Joab, don't let this thing upset you, Joab, as if it's going to upset Joab. There's no way to anticipate who the sword will cut down. Press the battle against the city, conquer it. Encourage him with these words. You win some, you lose some. That's the way it goes. Uriah was a great warrior, a man of godly character, and he had just died. And David does not express one word of grief, one expression of sorrow, doesn't give one word of tribute. David is unmoved. And a devastated Bathsheba is informed that her husband has been killed, and she mourns her loss. And so it seems that David has got away with adultery and murder, and yet our God doesn't operate like that, does he? The key sentence there is in verse 26. The end of verse 27. But what David had done upset the Lord. The King James says, displease. And that's a total contrast, isn't it? In verse 25, he says, don't let it displease you. These people had died. Uriah's dead. God was enraged, absolutely enraged by what David had done. And if David was to stand by and not come to God praying for forgiveness, God was going to do something about it. And that's what he does. And that's what that word means. He's upset. Imagine upsetting God, like outraged at what David had done. And God sends Nathan in verse 1 of chapter 12. And he tells a story. God sends Nathan. This is the moment in the life of David where everything in his world is about to come crashing down. And as we said at the beginning of the class, forgiveness of sin is one thing, but it doesn't take away the devastating consequences which ripped through the whole family. Nathan presents this story, isn't it? It's quite a sad story. There were two men in a city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except for a little lamb which he had acquired. He raised it up and it grew it alongside him and his children. He used to eat his food and drink from a cup and sleep in his arms. It was just like a daughter to him. When a traveller arrived at the rich man's home, he did not want to use one of his own sheep or cattle to feed the traveller who had come to visit him. Instead, he took the poor man's little lamb, he killed and he cooked it for the man who had come to visit him. David's reaction to this story, or hopefully we react the same, would be of any decent human being. It's a shocking story. We know what it's about, don't we? But David doesn't get it yet. I think what the writer is trying to indicate to David is the love between Uriah and Bathsheba and how David has snatched away a helpless lamb which belonged to someone else. You know, there's passages in the Bible or verses. When you read them, they give you goosebumps or, you know, they make you stop. And it might be sadness or some sort of emotion, a lump in the throat. And I believe this is one of those moments in verse 7. You are that man. Can you imagine that room with David and Nathan? And that story that was told. Consider those words, and David, knowing the man he was supposed to be, was shattered. His heart was broken at the actions that he had taken. You know what you've done, David? You've shown contempt for the word of God. You did evil in my sight. You killed Uriah. You took his wife. You killed him with the sword of my enemies. And you despised me by taking the wife of Uriah. David would have been devastated and he can only listen. What can he say? And there's consequences to those actions are listed out by Nathan. And he says in verse 13, David exclaims to Nathan, I have sinned against Yahweh. David acknowledges his sin with an open heart. There's no deflection or blame of others, just full responsibility for his actions. And there's so much more we could cover in this story, but the key to this we want to leave off for tonight is those wonderful words which we saw at the start God delivered through Nathan the prophet in verse 13. He says, yes, you know what? Yes, you have sinned and the Lord has forgiven you. And that's an amazing story as we read about the life of King David, isn't it? The lessons that he learnt along the way. He wasn't perfect, but he had a hope, the same hope that we have, and faith in our God. And the most exciting thing is that for us as well, we can read that and say, well, you've sinned, but the Lord can forgive you. David's God is our God. So when your life is tough, when you think, well, I'm just a filthy sinner, I can't, you know, God would even want to look at me. Just consider the life of King David, a man after God's own heart, who was forgiven. Because God cares for each and every one of us. And so if we choose his ways in our life, that's that wonderful hope that we can have when he says, I have forgiven your sin. So we've flown through the story, three stories of the life of David, and there's many more that you could go through. But it's an amazing story of forgiveness, no matter the sin, not without consequences, and it will go on, and you'll see that in the story with next time, maybe with Dion and further on. But I have forgiven your sin, and so you should look forward to that next class to see what happens next in the life of David. Thanks, everyone.